27. Blondes Never Win. One of our guest actresses on Cagney and Lacey played a woman whose husband goes missing. Christine and Mary Beth go to her home to interview her about the disappearance. Every take, this actress sobbed with tears running down her face, take after take. "God, you're good," I said to her after the fifth take from yet another angle. Tyne agreed. Very impressive. The guest actress turned to Tyne and said, "All I have to do is look into your big, soft brown eyes and I go to pieces. I lose it." There I stood with my metaphoric finger up my nose. The guest actress noticed and suddenly blurted out to me, "Oh, and I love your little tiny laughing blue eyes." I looked over at Tyne. Her big, soft brown eyes were brimming with suppressed laughter. For the next six seasons, any time there was an occasion for it, Tyne would tell me, "Did I tell you today that I love your little tiny laughing blue eyes?" Okay, I have deep-set eyes. The Cagney and Lacey cinematographer Hector Figueroa was well aware of it. He was a sensitive man who would have never called them tiny. He arranged to have a special light put above the lens of the camera to better bring out my diminutive peepers. He named it the Glessy. Hector always made Tyne and me look better than we actually did. That's what really good cinematographers do. And he was really good. He took care of me on the set. Then he took care of me off the set. Hector was a gorgeous Latino man. When he would step close to me to meter the light near my face, I could feel my stomach do a little flip-flop. His dark eyes would be looking at the meter, and mine would be looking at him. One late evening, we were filming at a downtown Los Angeles location near some railroad tracks. I asked Hector if we could speak. He followed me to a patch of dry grass between two rail cars where we could talk without being overheard. "I have a crush on you," I told him, with no lead-in. "I have a crush on you, too," he replied, with no wrap-up. He smiled. "Okay, well, I just wanted you to know that." We both turned around and walked back to join the others. The next week, he started to visit me in the makeup trailer in the mornings. Cinematographers don't usually hang out in makeup trailers. The rest of the cast and crew didn't even have to speculate about what was going on. It was pretty obvious. Hector was the sweetest, most thoughtful man I had ever known. And because he was single, we could actually be seen in restaurants together, and he would accompany me to various events. He would rub my feet at the end of a long day of shooting. I would drop off to sleep within minutes. The next morning, I would wake up to find that all my makeup from the previous day of filming had been wiped off with cold cream. Hector wasn't about to let my skin go to shit by my sleeping in full makeup for 6 hours. He had to film that face. When I finished showering in the morning, he would be standing there with a fresh hot towel that he would have warmed in the clothes dryer. During every hiatus, Hector and I would take a trip to the South Pacific. He would carefully pack my suitcase, making sure I had everything I would need. During our vacation, Hector would find out what I was wearing to dinner and would have a lei made to match my dress. Come on! Who does that? He was charming and funny and adapted to every situation. He would even be with me through the weekends with my best pals, Jay Michaels and Judith Ann. Hector would be the only sober attendee. They dubbed him the Saint. He was a saint. I felt so secure and loved with Hector. We were never apart. By my second season on the show, I also felt more secure in my role as Cagney. I started to get more opinionated about the Cagney and Lacey scripts, especially when Tyne and I would rehearse in my trailer at the end of the day. One night, after we attempted to read through an awkward scene twice, I said, "This is crap." Tyne said, "It is crap. You go in and tell Barney tomorrow morning it's your turn. I did it last time." The next day, I knocked on our executive producer's door, walked in, and threw the script down on his desk. "This is crap," Barney responded. "Crap? This is the best material that you've ever had in your entire career." I was so offended. "Fuck you," he countered. "Fuck me. Fuck you." I think it went better for Tyne. The last thing he heard was his door slamming as I walked out. Carol Smith, Barney's longtime assistant, would just look up from her desk with a bored expression that simply read, "They're at it again." She knew it would all blow over. Barney knew the scripts were sometimes overwritten, but he would let it stand until after the table reads. Tyne's and my chemistry was such that once we fully understood the intention of the written line, the words might no longer be needed. It could be done through physical or facial expressions alone. Barney counted on that. He would often say that the best writing on Cagney and Lacey was done with an eraser. Barney was the one who stayed in the edit bay all night, deciding which take to use, which of us would have the close-up, what footage best told the story. He knew our every nuance. He felt a great responsibility for the way females were represented in the show. Neither of us had been asked to show cleavage, wear a teddy, or act girly. Well, once in a while, Cagney would shamelessly use her femininity to get something she wanted. I thought those scenes were funny. We were two professional women. Our days on the set continued to be really long. A short day of filming would be 14 hours, but we were often there for 16 or 17. Maybe because I was dating one of their own, one Friday night I took it upon myself to be the crew's advocate and defender. We were shooting in downtown Los Angeles. It was a warm September night at 11 p.m., and we were filming a scene on top of an office building for our holiday episode. It had already been a 12-hour day, and we were supposed to move back to the studio to shoot the inside scenes at the precinct until 2 in the morning. We were all exhausted. I thought I'd be a hero for our hard-working crew. I decided that we should wrap for the day and do the precinct scenes on Monday morning. How's that for a blazing ego? We had all gathered in Tyne's trailer. Someone had phoned Barney, who was attending a black tie event, to let him know that I had suggested we change the schedule. Tyne told me, "I've got your back, I'm right here." Marty Cove and the other actors gave me their full support as well. About 15 minutes later, Barney arrived. He was wearing a tux and dress shoes. He stepped up inside Tyne's trailer. The crew lingered outside the door, waiting to hear whether they were done for the day. As was Barney's pattern when production came to a standstill, he looked at his watch and then asked, "What seems to be the problem?" I boldly stepped forward. "The crew is exhausted. We have all worked a long day. I think we should do the precinct scenes on Monday morning." Very calmly, Barney replied, "Well, that's not going to happen." I was tired and furious. Without thinking, responded by calling Barney a fucking shit. I can't even tell you how fast that trailer emptied out. Then Barney said, "We are now going to move production back to the studio and continue working. You're not going home. We have 3 more hours of work to finish." I huffed, "Fine." I grabbed my script and belongings, got into the car, and headed back to Lacey Street Studios. Once back at the precinct, we did a rehearsal for the scene we were about to shoot. Barney came to the set too, but I was still angry. I wouldn't look at or talk to him. After the rehearsal, I walked back to my trailer for a wardrobe change, still pissed. A minute later, I heard the sound of Barney's patent leather dress shoes approaching my trailer. I wasn't about to talk to him, so I went into my tiny bathroom at the back of the trailer and slammed the door shut. I heard him enter the trailer and close the door behind him. I stayed in the bathroom for 5 long minutes. But I could tell Barney wasn't going to leave. I felt like such a fool trapped in the can, I threw open the bathroom door and stormed right past him. With my nose in the air and in my haughtiest voice, I said, "This is ridiculous." I slammed the trailer door behind me and went back to the set. Barney didn't try to talk to me again that evening. Tyne and I finished the night's work. On Monday, Barney called me into his office before we started filming. He said, "Sit down, I want to talk to you." I was still carrying around a pile of indignation, but I flopped into a chair. "What?" He said, "The next time you want something, you come to me privately and ask. I will probably grant your request. But if you call me out in front of a crew, you will never win. Ever. The crew wants to know who is the boss, and they don't want it to be you." He wasn't speaking with anger. He was telling me how it was going to be. He was right, of course. I said, "Okay, got it. I'm sorry." His reaction to the incident only increased my respect for him. Every year of the series, Tyne and I were both nominated for the Emmy for Lead Actress in a Drama Series. Tyne Daly won 3 Emmys in a row in 1983, 1984, and 1985. Despite the personal sting, I was always gracious. I love Tyne Daly, and if I couldn't be the winner, I was happy for it to be my co-star. Every year, the day before the Emmys, Barney would stop by my trailer, hoping to spare me upcoming disappointment. "You're not going to win, you know. The blonde never wins." I told him, "Oh, I'll win. You'll see." He would then say, "Blondes never win in the dramatic category. Blondes only win in comedy." His theory proved true for the first 3 seasons. In our 4th year, I felt like I had a strong chance. I'd already won the Golden Globe Award for Lead Actress in a Drama that year. I had a feeling that the Emmy might be mine that season, too. Michael J. Fox was presenting for my category, along with Ally McGraw. Someone told me that during the earlier rehearsal, Michael had ad-libbed, announcing me as the winner. That night, when he opened the actual envelope, he said, "Oh, this is so great. Sharon Gless." I was stunned, but thrilled when he called my name. The first thing I said when I reached the podium to accept my Emmy was, "I'd like to thank my partner, Tyne Daly, who I am sure is the most relieved woman sitting in this room tonight." Later that night, Hector and I went to the post-Emmys party at Barney's home in Hancock Park. He and Barbara held a big catered event each year we were nominated. It was a great party. As we were getting ready to leave, I called out to Barney from across the room. "See, Barney? I told you a blonde can win an Emmy for drama." He walked toward me as I held my first Emmy award aloft. "No, they can't," he sweetly said. "Not unless they are you." If there were an exact moment to pinpoint when my feelings for Barney shifted, it would be in those silent seconds that followed. I didn't know it that evening, but I'd really never see Barney in the same way again. I knew he was married. I knew he was my boss. It had been well established from the beginning that Barney, Tyne, and I were a team, equal parts of a strong triangle. I clasped my Emmy Award tighter, hoping to quell my skipping heartbeat, and I walked out his front door. Before I got in the car, I decided on a course of action. I would pretend my feelings for him didn't exist. I was an actress, after all, and at last, an Emmy Award-winning one at that. '28. Buckle up! The New York State Police had a complaint about Cagney and Lacey. They called the studio to file a request. It was 1985, and wearing seatbelts in cars had become a mandatory law. The officers reported that when they stopped someone for speeding and noticed they were not wearing a seatbelt, the driver would often say, Cagney and Lacey don't wear seat belts. It was true. We always jumped in our unmarked squad car and drove off. The real-life police officers wanted us to buckle up on TV. It wasn't an unreasonable request from the police, and it wasn't one that CBS would refuse. However, I thought Christine Cagney would. She would feel that she should be exempt from this oppressive requirement. She wouldn't want the extra hassle of unbuckling a seatbelt. What if she had to jump out of the car quickly? Mary Beth would get behind the driver's wheel and say, "Seatbelt, Christine?" I wouldn't comply until she said, "I'm not moving until you buckle up." I wasn't fully aware of the momentum and the impact that our show was beginning to have on a national scale, that millions of people were tuning in and felt moved, inspired, or intrigued by the lives of Chris Cagney and Mary Beth Lacey. I didn't track the growing numbers of viewers or our overnight ratings or read the bags of fan letters that arrived at the studio. I didn't have time. I accepted that things were going well as long as we were given a go-ahead to shoot the next episode. I was happy. Monique was pleased when Pat Kingsley, the famous publicist who represented Sally Field, Doris Day, Natalie Wood, Jack Nicholson, and Robert Redford, noticed the increasing popularity of Cagney and Lacey and asked to take me on as a client. Pat usually only handled movie stars. Pat traveled with me for a big week-long publicity tour. Tyne took one half of the country, and I took the other. Early on in the week, Pat and I were in Washington, D.C. We spent the day going from show to show, doing interviews on every local TV and radio station, riding between venues in a stretch limo. Upon returning late in the day to the high-rise hotel in which we were staying, I opened my car door and was getting out when I heard Pat yell to me, "Run!" I had no idea what was happening. I ran full speed alongside her up some concrete steps across a slate-floored courtyard into the glass-fronted hotel and through the lobby. She guided me into an open elevator and pushed the closed doors button. Looking out from the elevator, I saw about 50 people chasing after me, shouting my name, trying to catch the elevator. I was petrified. My mouth dropped open. I pressed against the back of the elevator as the doors closed just in time. Pat was instantly cool and collected, straightening her jacket like it was just another workday for her. We were reaching our floor when I finally broke the silence. "Am I famous?" Pat started to laugh as we exited the elevator. She said, "Oh, please, God, may you never change." Soon after, I was invited to be on a popular BBC talk show hosted by Terry Wogan in London. When I was introduced and appeared from the side of the stage, the place erupted in screams. I flew off the ground. I'd had no idea. The studio audience in this large theater-style space was packed with avid Cagney and Lacey fans. As soon as I got off stage, I decided to get some fresh air. I went out the large wooden service door into the alley. The door closed behind me, and too late, I realized it automatically locked. I wasn't concerned until I turned to see hundreds of fans sealing off the end of the alley, people who had been unable to get seats at the show. They now noticed me, and more fans were joining them until they filled in all the empty space. I turned around and pounded my fist on the barn door. "Let me in! I'm locked out! It's Sharon Gless!" I heard a crew member say, "Sure you are," from the other side of the door, some scoffing laughter, and the sound of feet moving away. I tried hammering on the door. "Please! Let me in! It's Sharon! I'm locked out!" Even backstage security ignored my desperation. "Yeah, right." The only way back into the theater was through the alley and to the front door, which was blocked by countless fans. I was afraid they might try to rush toward me at any moment, but for now they stood in stunned silence, wondering, as was I, what to do. I cleared my throat and tried to steady my shaky voice. "Please, everyone, I'm very uncomfortable. I'm trapped back here. I was locked out. I need to get to the front door and back inside. The fans kindly parted, clearing a path for me to walk through. No one grabbed at me. Halfway through the crowd, I was praying, please, God, keep me safe. It's no wonder my mother would often tell me, Sharon, stop being so dramatic. I don't know what I thought would really happen, but the Cagney and Lacey fans in England were both gracious and sympathetic to my situation. They have continued to cheer me on for decades and still hold a place in my grateful heart. A couple of months later, I was invited to a private party at Chasen's restaurant in Beverly Hills. Many of the big-name executives and producers from the television industry were there. Monique had encouraged me to go to the party and mingle, but my natural shyness had me standing inside of the door by myself, hesitating to go in. Suddenly, Stephen Botchko, the Hill Street Blues creator, appeared beside me at the entrance. I had not seen him in years, since we were both under contract at Universal, I as a young actress and he as a fledgling writer. We'd been promising kids together. He had since gone on to major success and Emmy wins for creating and writing Hill Street Blues, and I had gone on to Cagney and Lacey. He gave me a quick hug. What brings you here tonight? I couldn't answer. My manager told me to come. So I said, oh, I just came to hang out with all the swells. Stephen turned me towards the crowded room. Do you recognize anyone here? I was a bit embarrassed, but I answered truthfully, no. He leaned in to whisper to me, me either. I think that means that you and I are the swells now. Come on, let's go enjoy it. I left 20 minutes later. XXIX. Blowing My Cover. I would never drink or do drugs on the job. God knows I did some damage on my own time, but never on the set. For me, timing is everything. Acting is like music. The note that is put on a specific word affects the emotion of an entire line of dialogue. I had to be completely sober to perform. Booze and drugs did only one thing, throw my timing off. We worked with a large variety of directors on Cagney and Lacey. It kept the show fresh. I was closest to Ray Danton. Ray had been an actor. He was philosophical and intellectual, but appreciated everything done well artistically. On the set, between lighting setups, we sang show tunes together. The musical Sweeney Todd was a Broadway smash at the time. I taught Ray the words to one of Sondheim's best. Nothing's gonna harm you, not while I'm around. Demons are prowling everywhere nowadays. I'll send them howling. I don't care. I've got ways. The night I won my first Emmy, I arrived home late to a telegram left on my front door. It was from Ray Danton. Demons are prowling everywhere, he wrote. But not tonight. Love, Ray. He had the highest expectations while directing, which got him invited back often, to the dismay of the crew. They had T-shirts printed up with the words, I survived Midnight Danton. He wouldn't let actors get away with anything less than truly authentic performances, and he was direct when he thought any of us were sliding into a bag of tricks or our typical routines. Once he took me to the side and whispered, I think we've seen that before, don't you? I burst out laughing. I knew he was right. With Ray, there was always a second chance to make a performance better. I loved him for it. I was fortunate enough to be given a couple of second chances on Cagney and Lacey. One of those I didn't deserve. Tyne and I always put the show first. We would come in early and stay late. She would show up every morning looking fabulous, dressed in a sexy outfit and heels, and then transform herself into Mary Beth Lacy, with her skirts and practical blouses. Tyne would say that she felt that Mary Beth was the person who never had time to look at the back of her head in a mirror. She thought she should have electric roller dents in her hair. I was the complete opposite. I'd roll out of bed, take a shower, and wash my hair. I'd head into work with wet hair, wearing nothing but a terry cloth robe and penny loafers. Because of our long hours, the show supplied both Tyne and me with cars and drivers to take us to and from the studio each day. The hair and makeup people would be waiting to turn my tired and perhaps hungover face into that of Chris Cagney. One morning, my makeup man said, "Who was that in here yesterday, your younger sister?" No matter how rough I looked, my team could piece my face back together. I hoped they'd like a good challenge, because I often gave them one. By the time they finished, I'd look in the mirror and think, "Wow, I look pretty." My dresser would have my wardrobe laid out for me from foundation to footwear. I didn't have to think about any of it. After we were done for the day, and Tyne and I had rehearsed in my trailer, I would strip back down to only my robe and penny loafers, often go out for sushi, have a scotch or two, spill a little soy sauce on my script, go home, and fall into bed at about 1 a.m. I'd always make it back for the next day of work, starting at 5 a.m. Work never impeded me from indulging in a couple of drinks at the end of the day or enjoying a little cocaine on my days off. It was the 80s. Cocaine was rampant in the entertainment industry. John Belushi died of an overdose. Richard Pryor set himself on fire. Automaker John DeLorean was arrested for smuggling, and Boston Celtics top draft pick Len Bias collapsed and died, all connected to cocaine in the 1980s. But that's the problem with the drug. It makes you believe that you are the most indestructible and fascinating superhuman to ever tread the earth. You have no clue what a crashing bore you really are. Barney was intolerant of any drugs and fired a whole camera crew when he found out they were using cocaine on the set. Ironically, and unbeknownst to Barney, I would buy my cocaine from one of those crewmen. One evening, Tyne and I met up for our regular nightly read-through in my trailer. While we were rehearsing, we had a couple of drinks. Everyone had left except for our two drivers who were waiting to take us home. We should have gone home this particular night, but I decided to break out the cocaine. I take complete responsibility for my being so, well, irresponsible. We both partook. I knew better, but I've never been one for self-denial. We became undefeatable, indefatigable, and impressively insightful about our interpretations of the lines. Then it all wore off at 4 a.m. I had lost track of time. I was due back for my call time in 1 hour. I panicked. I knew I couldn't be on camera anytime soon. "Tyne, I can't go to work. I'm in really bad shape." Tyne seemed almost fine. She would have probably pushed through and done her work for the day, but I couldn't. I devised a plan. I called Monique James. I needed her help. I could tell her just about anything, but using cocaine was not going to be cool with her at all, especially not at the studio. "Miss James, I've been up all night with Tyne. We were running lines in my trailer. We had drinks. I'm loaded. I can't work today." Monique said, "Okay. Thank you for calling me. I'll call Barney now and tell him you got the flu during the night." I knew, by my calling in sick, that Barney would rearrange the schedule to not lose time. Tyne would be expected to film her scenes with Harvey and the two kids. She didn't seem happy about that. Tyne said, "I don't want to work if you aren't." I came up with part B to my plan so that Tyne could go home too. I looked at the call sheet for the coming day of filming. "You're in luck," I said. "John Carlin is on a hold and not a will notify. The difference is that a will notify actor may be called into work, so he must stay near his home phone. With a hold, the actor isn't obligated to stay home at all. "Call Johnny," I told Tyne. "Tell him to go to the racetrack for the day." There were no cell phones in those days, so John Carlin would be unreachable. If he wasn't available, then Tyne would be free as well. It was a pretty foolproof plan, and it worked. I went home and to bed. Shutting down production for a day cost roughly $70,000 to $80,000 in the mid-80s. To recover the costs through insurance, the studio had to send an insurance doctor to the ill actor's home to confirm that she or he was really too sick to work. It was almost a joke in Hollywood. They phoned the industry physician that actors referred to as Dr. Feelgood because he was so predictable about reporting the flu for celebrities with hangovers or drug withdrawals. He came in, gently poked my stomach twice, and filed the report that I was suffering influenza. Thank God he didn't look up my nose. He probably knew better. Even though this cover-my-ass plan had worked in total, I was choking on my own guilt. I had cost the studio and Barney a lot of money and angst. The next day, my shame was so consuming that I went into Barney's office before we started filming for the day. I told him the whole story, except I didn't mention that it was cocaine. If he had fired a whole camera crew over cocaine, I thought he might look up Loretta Swit to play Cagney again, since MASH had recently gone off the air. I stuck with the story I told Monique about being drunk. I confessed that I'd thought up the whole scheme for getting the day off. Barney listened, leaned back in his chair, and said, "Thank you for telling me." I felt so chagrined. "I will pay you back," I said. "I will write you a check for all of it." "I may have you do that," Barney nodded. "I'll get back to you." He was not smiling. I hadn't expected him to say that. If I wrote a check to cover it, then the insurance company and studio would also know the truth about my sick day. I didn't know how I would live that down. Barney let me sweat it out all day long. I couldn't believe that I might have to pay five figures and live through the humiliation of being the one who was too drunk to work. I suffered in silence. Tyne had no idea I had told Barney anything at all. I was alone in my panic. At the very end of the day, Barney called me into his office and closed the door. "You're off the hook. It's all been handled. This time. But if you ever do something like that again, you will be writing me a check." Check. Big check. Got it. We've got issues. Mary Beth Lacey has a lumpectomy and the stress of a breast cancer scare. Christine Cagney grapples with her moral conviction regarding abortion when she has a possible unplanned pregnancy. The detectives have to decide if a little girl is the victim of sexual abuse. Cagney conceals a heroic illegal immigrant from the FBI to keep him from being deported without his wife and children. Lacey provides her high school-aged son with a condom for his prom night. The show covered it all. Date rape, female abduction, teenage sex, women's health issues, alcoholism, and domestic violence. For the first time on national TV, topics that were of concern to women were the subject matter of a primetime television drama with two female leads. They were detectives. They took action on issues. The language was definitive and strong. Mary Beth could go to work, and her husband could cook dinner for the kids. Christine could date, sleep around, and never consider marriage. They could aspire to job titles only held by men in the past. This was a dramatic departure from TV dramas of the time, in which women were most often relegated to playing supportive wives, nurses, receptionists, waitresses, or victims of crime themselves. Cagney and Lacey also had numerous female writers and directors, many more than any other one-hour drama show in the 1980s. And the fans loved it. 20 to 30 million viewers watched Cagney and Lacey every week. At one point, on a hiatus between seasons, I was in Toronto doing a made-for-TV movie, Letting Go, with the wonderful comic actor John Ritter. In the movie, his wife had died in a plane crash. He was raising his young son alone and trying to overcome depression. I played his new love interest, a teacher who was struggling to be free of a bad relationship. We met in group therapy. Though the circumstances were serious and sad, there were plenty of comic moments between John and me. John was the most thoughtful and funny man, both on and off the set. He could make me laugh all day long. His dad was the famous cowboy actor-singer Tex Ritter. His mother, the Western actress Dorothy Fay. He was a verifiable Hollywood kid, but had none of the entitlement or snobby quality of being from a famous family. His mother told me that when John was 5, they lived on a ranch in the San Fernando Valley. John's favorite animal was the rooster that would crow at sunrise every morning. One day, the rooster suddenly died. Dorothy sat John down and explained to her young son that the rooster had become very sick and had to go to rooster heaven. John took in the news and then sadly asked, "But Mama, who will bring the dawn?" John died unexpectedly at age 54. A few days before he passed away, he asked if I would play opposite him in a stage play he wanted to do. I would have loved working with him again. Once you knew John, you couldn't imagine not knowing him. I still can't believe he's gone. Who will bring the dawn, indeed? During my second week of the 5-week shooting schedule for Letting Go, I got a phone call from Barney with the news that Tyne Daly was pregnant. I was asked to return to L.A. immediately. They needed to start production on a number of scripts before Tyne's belly would begin to show. It was going to cost no less than a cool $1 million to bring back the cast and crew and have production up and running 6 weeks before scheduled. I understood the dilemma, but I wouldn't abandon John Ritter in our movie before it was done. I called Monique to tell her the news. I was contractually supposed to be given 3 full months off from Cagney and Lacey. That would have been plenty of time to film a TV movie and then take a 2-week break before returning to work on Cagney and Lacey. Not this time. I came back to L.A. the day after filming wrapped and went immediately into costume fittings and script readings. We had to shoot 6 months' worth of my scenes with Tyne in about 6 weeks. Eventually, it was written into the season that Mary Beth was pregnant. It was emotionally loaded and realistic. Tyne had 2 teenage daughters. Her oldest was already 17. Mary Beth had 2 teenage sons. Art would reflect real life. Tyne had asked to not film the scene in which Mary Beth Lacey delivers her show baby until after she had given birth to her real-life infant. After a short maternity leave, Tyne returned to the show with her new baby girl, Alexandra, in tow. She was given a pregnancy belly to wear, constructed from foam rubber. Tyne had to make a different one, insisting that a pregnant woman's belly moves and is heavy. They redesigned it at her suggestion, using birdseed in place of foam. One of my favorite scenes to shoot was Mary Beth calling on Christine to get her to the hospital when she'd gone into early labor. Chris, in her yellow Corvette convertible, frantically drives Mary Beth across New York's 59th Street Bridge until traffic gridlock brings them to a standstill. Then her car breaks down. Production had actually rented half of the bridge for the day. Considering it was a full-day shoot, the nanny would bring baby Alexandra to Tyne to be nursed in the convertible in the middle of the 59th Street Bridge, and production would pause for 20 minutes. Unlike on House Calls, where Lynn Redgrave was fired for wanting to nurse her baby at work, our producer and crew made accommodations for our newest family member, building a nursery for Zanny next to the precinct set, and the show went on. I won my first Emmy for an episode, The Gimp, about crimes targeting disabled people in wheelchairs. Actor James Stacy, who had lost an arm and one leg in an actual motorcycle accident, plays a disability advocate who is assisting Cagney in the investigation. Though the connection is initially combative, Cagney finds herself attracted to him. In one scene, it becomes obvious that they are about to become sexually involved, as he unbuttons the top of her blouse. He did it with great skill. I guess if you practice, only one hand is needed. His physical disabilities became only a backdrop to his magnetic charm. Cagney is smitten. It shook the foundation of traditional romance. It was compelling storytelling, and I thought, very sexy. I never wanted Cagney to be a victim of an outside force that she couldn't handle. I wanted any pain she faced to come from her own choices. Addressing any negative truth about herself was not her greatest skill. Right before we broke for hiatus, the writers met to discuss the direction of the lead characters for the upcoming season. What would be the arc of the storyline for Cagney and Lacey, for the women together, and each alone? Christine and Mary Beth were now each fully ensconced in midlife. How had 4 years as partners on the NYPD changed them? Would they be more defined and refined by their successes, or bothered by a haunting what-if scenario? Would there be a shift in their personal relationships, a misfortune, a boost, or a blow to their self-esteem? Earlier in the month, an interviewer had said to me, "It's so obvious that Christine is the adult child of an alcoholic. Everything she does, from her lack of commitment to anyone, to her impulsivity, to stuffing her feelings down, is a trait. Anger is her root emotion, not to mention the fact that she's an alcoholic herself." I took the observation to Barney. Though neither of us had ever thought of Cagney as an alcoholic, there was no doubt that she was a drinker. It was never written into the script, but some mornings, for the sake of humor, I would ask Tyne to have 2 aspirin ready for me in her open palm when I walked by her desk. Lacey would know that Cagney was often suffering the after effects of drinking the night before. I would play the hangover headache by dropping into my desk chair and pressing my thumb into the corner of one eye. Barney asked me if I'd be willing to explore the idea fully. I was. He reminded me that I had never wanted Cagney to be portrayed or played as a victim. I said I knew I hadn't, but this was different, and I was willing to look at it. Soon after, Barney went before the show's writers. "Let me give you the last line of dialogue from the last scene of the last episode of the forthcoming season," he began. He set the scene for the listening staff. "We are in a tight 2-shot of our stars, and they are seated. We don't know where they are. Finally, Cagney stands and says, 'My name is Christine, and I'm an alcoholic.'" The writer stopped taking notes and looked up at Barney. He continued, "A wide shot then reveals they're at an AA meeting. The end." The staff applauded. This was fresh stuff. No lead on a TV drama had ever dealt with this disease. "Now," he said, "your job is to backtrack over the 21 episodes that precede this and figure out a way to get us to that moment." Cagney, the heroine, was about to have her own day of reckoning and would fall from her professional pedestal because of her personal life. Sharon, the actress, would fall in love with her married executive producer and keep it on the down low for professional reasons. It seems we both had issues. Art imitates life, bliss and mess and all. How's that for a cliffhanger? We had issues. London was calling. It was the 50th anniversary of the BBC. Cagney and Lacey was one of the hottest TV shows on the air in England. The Brits were besotted with the New York female cops. Tyne and I received invitations to appear at the Theatre Royal Drury Lane for their anniversary celebration performance. We were the only Americans invited to appear on stage that evening. The biggest British celebrities would be there. The press would most certainly be there in huge numbers. Paul McCartney was on the bill to perform. Her Majesty the Queen Mother would be attending. She would be greeting each performer individually after the show. I tried to focus on the honor of it all, but I was in a head-spinning trance from the passionate and unrestrained affair I was having with my executive producer, Barney Rosenzweig. Love really must be blind, because before the show, Paul McCartney asked me for my autograph, and I didn't recognize him. Unimaginable, yet true. I didn't even ask him for his autograph in return. Jesus. Our affair didn't start in London. Months earlier, I had been chosen for the Genie Award from the American Women in Radio and Television in 1986. It was a great honor. Robert Wagner and the executive producer of Turnabout, Sam Denoff, both spoke for me. They also asked Barney to give some introductory remarks about my work before I was presented with the award. He chose not to speak. Instead, he edited together a compilation film of the highlights of scenes from my career. The flow of countless images of me across the screen was musically supported by the Joe Cocker recording of You Are So Beautiful. In the dark room, Barney reached over and held my hand under the table and then whispered, I wish the lights would never come up. My heart went into freefall. Our intense mutual attraction surged higher with each passing day after that, until one night Barney and I had spontaneous sex in my trailer on the studio lot. It was a completely reckless thing to do. The next morning, before we started work for the day, Barney stopped by my trailer. I was still on an emotional high from the previous night. Any regrets? I asked, confident his answer would be the same as mine. I was smiling. The grin left my face when he answered, yes. This was a mistake, he said. I'm married. I'll never be with you for any important occasions, your birthday, or any holidays. He continued on with a litany of reasons why this affair would never work. I can't even call you whenever I want, he said. The stakes were monumentally high in both his personal and professional life. Everything he had worked so hard to build could be destroyed if anyone found out about us. We both decided that our trailer tryst would be a one-time lapse in judgment. It was a bad idea to ever let anything happen between us again. For a while, we held to our word. Then London called. Tyne's then-husband, George Stanford Brown, would be traveling with her. Barney's wife, Barbara, was by this time president of TV production for Columbia Studios and was too busy to make the trip. And so it was, the four of us. We had first-class seats in a long transatlantic flight from L.A. to London. Barney and I sat one row ahead of Tyne and George. They slept. We did not. I was given a beautiful suite at the Ritz Hotel, with tall French windows and billowy diaphanous curtains. A canopy of silk hung over the bed. The trip had been planned so that we had a full day to rest up before appearing in a professional capacity at any event. 24 unscheduled hours broke our will, and soon Barney came up the back stairwell of the hotel to my suite. A winter thunderstorm blew into the city, and as the rain pelted the windows, Barney and I made love. When we rested, we would find a reason to have an argument. We had many issues with no resolution. It was infuriating. The makeup sex was great. I don't think we ate or slept at all before it was time to be presented to the Queen Mother. I was worried that Tyne would sense that something had gone on between Barney and me, but she didn't. I felt like a stranger to myself. I would never have intentionally hurt her. Luckily, she was with George, and the excitement of the royal event provided plenty of distraction. The night before we flew back to the U.S., the four of us decided to see a new musical that had opened only days earlier in London's West End. It was The Phantom of the Opera. Barney and I had spent our final day of the trip still in the hotel room, making love and then arguing, making love and arguing again. He isn't one to pad any of his opinions, and at some point he said something that cut me to the quick. He left to get ready for the theater, and I spent the next hour in tears. In our shared limo on the way to the theater, we chatted with Tyne and George, but didn't engage with each other at all, not even making eye contact. Four tickets had been set aside for us, but not together. Tyne and George took the pair of seats toward the back of the theater, leaving Barney and me in the very front row. I stayed silent. I was still so hurt. 15 minutes into the first act, I found myself crying again. I couldn't believe how much the storyline of the musical reflected my current reality. The heroine, ironically named Christine, must choose between this otherworldly and compelling figure of mystery or return to the safe arms of her loyal beau. The parallel aspects of Phantom seemed to be affecting Barney as well. We were in a dream that could so easily become a nightmare. But neither of us was willing to wake up to reality yet. During the intermission, I went to the ladies' room. I had dressed for the show in a red suede suit with a gorgeous long skirt and knee-high boots. My eyes were shiny from crying. When I came out of the restroom, Bonnie was there with a cocktail for me. He whispered in the sexiest, saddest voice, "I want to fuck you right here. Right now." Other people may not understand this, but in that moment, it was the perfect thing to say to me. Once we landed in Los Angeles, Hector and I had plans to immediately catch a flight to Monterey to spend Thanksgiving with my mother in Carmel. Barney got into his waiting limo. Barbara had come to pick him up. She had run into the terminal to get something Barney had left behind on the plane. The darkened window in the rear passenger seat was rolled up. I knocked on the glass to say goodbye. Barney opened the window, and I could see that there were tears on his face. That's the moment I knew it was more than a week-long affair that would only become a secretive memory. He was in love with me. I continued dating Hector, but my thoughts were always on Barney. Hector and I had been together for 5 years. I loved him very much, but I knew it would never be the same. "You have to love him enough to let him go," my therapist advised me. She was right. Hector deserved a lot better than a woman who was in love with someone else, even though I knew my relationship with the very married Barney couldn't go anywhere. One morning, as Hector left to go to work, I told him that I had met someone. I didn't say who it was. I was crying. As he walked out the door, he turned to me and said, "I'm a good man." That weekend, I decided to drive to Carmel. I was devastated by what I had done to Hector. I needed the comfort of my mom and to get out of L.A. My doorbell rang. It was Barney. He had heard that I had broken it off with Hector and had come by to check on me. He wanted to see if I needed anything before I left on my trip. "I'm not okay," I began to sob. "I miss Hector, and I can't pack my fucking suitcase." Barney looked at my various piles of clothes, hats, and shoes and said, "Would you like me to show you how to pack?" I thought it was a very loving offer. I choked out a tearful, "Yes, please." I sat on the couch, wiping the tears from my eyes. Barney packed the suitcase beautifully, smoothing out all the clothes and fitting my shoes perfectly into the sides. Then he asked gently, "There, did you see how I did that?" I nodded, now smiling, and said, "Yes, thank you." He said, "Good." Then, with one swift move, he picked up the suitcase, flipped it over at waist level, and dumped everything out onto the floor. I sat in complete shock. He said to me, "Cute and helpless isn't sexy anymore, Sharon." I had no argument. Could I defend my being an insipid little crybaby? I was embarrassed to the core. But my face wasn't red with humiliation. It was flushed with attraction. Barney wasn't going to enable my childishness. He expected more of me. He was very strong. He sat on the couch and watched as I picked up each piece of clothing and put it back in the suitcase. It was sexy as hell. I knew I would be treading into dangerous territory with this married man. I was familiar with the trail, but had no idea of the destination.